Today, we're honored to have a guest whose work has helped shape some of the most exciting productions in recent years, most notably and recently Six, as you played a big role in the show's unique pop concert meets musical theater, bringing that to life, ensuring that audiences feel every beat, harmony, and lyric with crystal clear precision. So today, we're excited to dive into the creative process, the evolution of sound design in modern theater, and what it takes to make a show like Six so electrifying. So Paul, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Michelle. Thanks, Eric. Great to be here. Big fan of the podcast.
Thank you. So why don't you start by telling us how your involvement in Six came to be, the origination for that?
Yeah, it was it's through a kind of evolution of a lot of my associate work with the Cameron Mackintosh organization. There was a composer who worked on Mary Poppins, like one of the George Stiles, who wrote a lot of the score that goes alongside the original Sherman Brothers score. So I knew kind of George from there, and he was one of our producers on Six. So he was kind of fairly instrumental in pulling a few of the creative team together for people that he'd known before and had experience of working with before. And that was one of my kind of, along with Mary Poppins, that was one of my first kind of solo designs, as it were, after kind of a 20-year kind of career of being a mixer and an assistant and an associate designer, and kind of going through those kind of tiered positions, gaining experience, and that kind of culminated in that. And is lucky to get that as one of my first designs, you know.
Can you talk about the jump from associate to head and what the different responsibilities are and what you took on in these newer roles compared to what responsibilities were in your, I'll call it, your professional upbringing?
Yeah, absolutely. Associates are kind of key members of the sound design team, and they play a support role and a kind of facilitation role. And they can also act as a kind of proxy for the designer when productions get remounted in different territories, or there's maybe a cast change or something like that. In terms of transitioning to a designer, that's when you kind of assume ultimate responsibility for the sound of the show and become kind of head of the department. And then you're kind of looking for your own associates to work with that you can build that relationship with. It takes, I'd say, probably a good kind of 5 years to develop a working relationship with someone that you can be on the same plane, where you don't really, you know what the other one's thinking, and you know, you can kind of act in each other's stead. I think importantly, the associate can understand the taste of the designer, this kind of sonic taste and sonic preferences. It's a great skill, actually. They have to kind of remove their own tastes from the process and kind of act in someone else's, you know, ears, if you like.
Does that create tension? If somebody else's ears have a different preference, does that become a learning opportunity of, wait, somebody else has another perspective that might help inform me? Is there a lot of competition within teams, or is it really cohesive and working together?
Yeah, it's definitely a cohesive environment, and it has to be. Otherwise, we'd be kind of pulling in different directions, and we would never get to the same finish line, as it were. And that goes across all the departments. I think Simon Hayes talked a lot about how important like collaboration between music and sound is. But I think for the sound designer, we kind of interface with most departments across the production, whether that's music team, obviously the acting company, or the musicians. We have to interface with wardrobe to work in kind of microphones and monitoring solutions. So that's just the same within the sound team themselves. It's a very important kind of key, like, foundation that we're all kind of pulling in the same direction. It can be, you know, that's sometimes tricky because, you know, as you know, everyone hears very differently, and everyone has different frequency responses and level thresholds. But it's also a good check and balance if you've got a different pair of ears, because ultimately the kind of 1,000 people in the audience are going to hear the show in a different way. And we need to get the best average of all of that. So I think as many people that can feed into the process and can provide value in how things are sounding is a good thing. You know?
How do you go about trying to get the best average response for, as you said, everybody's going to have a different perspective on it, and everybody's sitting in different seats or at different areas within the theater? How do you account for that average response?
I think fundamentally it's down to the system design, and which is a kind of a creative slash technical process in terms of designing a loudspeaker system for a, you know, an arts venue, whether that's a theater or a concert or, you know, anywhere. It's about even distribution of level and frequency, tonality, essentially. Level and tonality are the two key aspects to achieving linear kind of response across the whole listening plane. Once you've got that, once you've kind of built your system, then that becomes your kind of canvas, if you like. I always equate it to kind of building your own studio each time you kind of go into a theater. You know, have to start from scratch because they're often empty vessels, and all the equipment that we bring in is rented, and it's all under our specification and put together by our engineers. Once you've got to that point, then you can start creating, if you like. And you know that the work you've done up to that point is going to provide the audience wherever they're sitting. So you can't get it. It's not a perfect science because some auditoriums have different shapes, like fan shapes are quite tricky, little kind of box areas. So you have to use a distributed system to cover those areas as best you can and provide kind of a full kind of immersive experience. So I would always use a surround system. I would focus a lot on low frequency and making sure that the show sits on a really comfortable bed of low frequency. The audience get that kind of visceral experience. Whether it's Mary Poppins or Six, you still want to have a connection. You know, we still want to move air in the right way that people start to feel things when the, you know, that air starts to kind of connect with them.
I like what you said about it, how it's not precise or talking about averages. We speak with our patients about the art and the science of what we do, that certain aspects are just scientific. You're dealing with physics, acoustics, waves, but then you're also dealing with perception, and you're dealing with how people receive this sensory stimulation that they're giving you. Can you speak to some of the differences that you encounter in different rooms that, at least speaking about Broadway, you're talking about theaters that are old. The spaces are different than spaces that are designed today. Can you talk about working in the specific rooms you work in?
Yeah, it kind of runs the gamut, really, from brand new venues, which are often much drier than the heritage venues, as we kind of call them, which would be the kind of Broadway theatres, most of the West End theatres. So we're encountering a huge range of acoustic issues that we need to manage. Sometimes that involves implementing a kind of artificial kind of room reverberation system into the kind of surround to kind of expand the size of the space a little bit. But yeah, it kind of, every space is different, and it has its kind of, its quirks and its good points. I think low frequency, again, is the hardest thing to deal with in any of these venues because it becomes so kind of uneven and undulates wherever you kind of move to. So one of my big system design principles is focusing low frequency from one source. So it kind of emanates from one position and is condensed, and everyone has the same kind of relationship to that position of kind of low frequency from the subwoofers. So you don't kind of break that apart too much. And that becomes your anchor, and then you can start to build out the system from there with upwards in the kind of frequency range. But you're talking about perception. I think that's a huge thing that we have to deal with, not only the audience, but also in our wider team that we work with, from the director through to composers, music supervisors, the music director, the person who's mixing the show. Everyone has such a different perception. So it's about navigating all those opinions, all those kind of thoughts and desires and wants. You know, maybe I might get to put a little bit myself in there as well at some point. But and some people have very definite opinions, and some people can just let you kind of, you know, organically develop sound of the show and then may kind of feedback into it, you know, later on. I think certainly in the more modern musicals, which are based on kind of, has a kind of fundamental kind of pop music score, which is a lot of what I do, that kind of comes from studio production. A lot of people are now creating that music at home, and they have a good idea how to create it and how they want that to translate into the theater.
Now, something so notable and unique about Six is that each queen is meant to embody the style of different pop singers, whether it's Britney Spears or Ariana Grande. Beyonce, I've heard a whole bunch of pop singers that they're trying to replicate or embody. How do you capture the essence of each style for each singer?
I think a lot of that is baked into the writing. So that's kind of baked into the songwriting. It mostly is inflected in the kind of style of the singing, the vocal kind of delivery, whether that's the riffs or the kind of tonality of the voice. And then, of course, we're kind of using effects which could be associated with that singer, you know, to kind of, in terms of like reverbs, delays, and all those kind of those layers and different textures that we build up to kind of give someone a cue that, yes, that might be kind of Beyonce and that might be like Ariana Grande and all those kind of things.
When you're talking about low frequency and that you're really focusing on giving that low frequency bass to the audience, what frequency range are you specifically focusing on for that with the subs?
And we're talking, I think, from 100, 120 hertz down all the way to as low as I can get, really.
Oh, that's really low.
Wow.
Yeah, so I want as much kind of power at 40 hertz as I'm getting at 100 hertz. And obviously that's the kind of Fletcher Munson curves of the year. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot more power to kind of perceive the same sensitivity at low frequencies than it does high frequencies.
Yes.
So we're building a lot of weight into the system and a lot of kind of low-end power to be able to deliver that. And you have to be able to convey that through, you know, the whole house as well. So it takes a lot of large speakers, basically, and a lot of power. So we'll kind of put up as much as we can in the best position that we can. And obviously that has to integrate with scenery, lighting, sight lines for follow spots. There's a lot of fun kind of factors. Everyone's kind of fighting for the same real estate.
And also, isn't there a live band on stage also that you're squeezing in on stage?
Yeah, we have a four-piece band on stage, and there's a lot of production elements on track as well. So it's very much a hybrid score between the four live musicians and a lot of pop production in terms of kind of beats and, you know, a lot of keyboard textures and, you know, whooshes and kind of things that we can put in surround to give dynamic movement to things. Yeah, the band are kind of all designed to be what we call silent, which sounds a bit funny, but it's essentially electric drum kit with some really great studio samples. Mm-hmm. Obviously the bass and the guitar are DI'd. We don't use any amplifiers on stage, and the keyboard is an electronic instrument anyway. So by design, we're containing all that sound in a really controllable way. So we have complete control how we hear the band. If we close the band faders, we won't get anything. So we can do exactly what we want to. We're not kind of beholden to like an acoustic drum kit source on stage, which then creates kind of timing problems and spill problems. So it's very important to kind of design in the kind of outcome that you want and give yourself the most flexibility, really.
That's fascinating to me. I'm thinking of how you're working then with the musical team. When they're writing these shows, are they factoring in that, hey, I probably shouldn't be thinking acoustic guitar on this because then that's going to create stage noise that we want to avoid that you can mm-hmm. then control with the electronic kits or an electric guitar by not having it amplified on stage? Are they thinking about that? Are they consulting you on their production end and the construction of what they're trying to do? Or does it all just kind of come together later?
I think for the most part, it depends how early I can come into the project, but I'll certainly feed into ideas that, hey, that might be a problem, that might be a clash. I'd never really think of myself as a sound designer. I always come at it as a kind of music producer, or, you know, even like audio director might be a kind of better term. Sound design for me always feels more on the content side, you know, more related to kind of film, drama. The music for me is where the heart of the storytelling is. And I'm lucky to work with teams that I can get involved with early, take their ideas and maybe kind of feedback into areas that could be improved in terms of frequency balances, mm-hmm. or where the vocal might get lost because we've got some orchestration that might need a bit of space clearing out of it. So yeah, for me, that's a kind of fundamental part of my workflow, really. It wouldn't really work if I was just kind of beholden to not be able to kind of get involved in that way. And some scores don't require that. Maybe on a kind of more of a classical book score, it's orchestrated in a way which is kind of fully orchestral based. So a natural orchestra has all its frequencies kind of spread out from bottom to top in the right way, whether that's contrabass, cello, violin, you know, viola, they all sit in their own pocket, nothing really overlaps. So there's kind of there's times where you need to get involved more and you can kind of help the music in that way. And then there's times where an orchestration will be crafted in such a way which doesn't just plays itself, you know. And I always say that some shows just mix themselves because they're sort of put together in such a great way fundamentally, in terms of orchestration, writing, you know, you it's really then your job to take that and kind of present it to the audience in the best way.
You had mentioned that it makes it easier that you're fortunate to come onto projects relatively early, and then it can certainly help with the formulation of how things get started. Are there any projects you've come onto a little bit later in the game, and are there what kind of challenges are posed with coming on a little bit later?
That's a good question. I think I've been quite lucky in the fact that all the teams I've worked with have been just highly kind of collaborative, and I've not really come into a situation yet where we kind of clash. So maybe I've just been lucky. Maybe that, you know, it happened one day maybe. But generally working with extremely talented kind of people, orchestrators, writers, and they know what they want, and I kind of know how to achieve it, and then we kind of meet in the middle. Sometimes that's a technical solution. Sometimes it's a solution more based around how the orchestration stacks up in terms of, you know, frequencies. I just deal with frequencies a lot because there's so much kind of there could be a tendency to throw a lot of things into an orchestration, which just caught because you want it to sound big and impressive and huge. But a lot of times that kind of has the opposite effect. Things go smaller and there's a lot of masking that occurs. And then you try and put a vocal in with that and, you know, it becomes a real big fight. So trying to make sure everything has its place, everything has its pocket, you know, clear kind of defined places for things is where I kind of can add value, I think.
I would also expect that with having six lead female singers, that some of them have more powerful, loud voices than some of the other ones. And it's all about balancing to make sure that one doesn't overpower the other, because sometimes they each get their own song, but you don't want one vocalist to sound so much stronger, or like meaning louder than and powerful than the others. And then when they're all singing together, to balance all six voices equally.
Yeah, it can be. And that's the kind of role on six, get to get the vocal package sounding like a real cohesive kind of unit. And we deal with that in a number of ways, kind of dynamic EQ, multiband compression, several layers of kind of processing to sort of like frequencies don't build up and start to hurt, you know, in the kind of high mid range. So again, it's about keeping things like open sounding, clear and balanced. And that way you're kind of you'll feel you can listen to things, you can have it loud, but it's not going to feel overpowering or oppressive or painful. You know, that's the kind of ultimate goal, is to make it sound big, bigger, big, open and clear. I think that's my taste, as it were.
Cool.
So in achieving that big, open and clear, when you are using compression, how do you keep the distortion that compression creates from getting in the way of achieving that big, open and clear?
Yeah, it's a good question, I think, because sometimes the distortion element of that is a desirable artifact.
Mm.
So we might use a multiband compressor to, as a kind of first pass, just balance out the kind of tonal variance in the voice, especially when you're very close to a microphone. There's going to be proximity effect. There's going to be a tonal imbalance in the high mids, and you need to kind of readdress that. I think the best way to do that is with kind of multiband compression, the most transparent way to do that initially. And then I might follow that up with plugins which have more of a character. So then we can kind of control things in a quicker way, control the peaks in a quick way, but also impart some kind of flavor and some kind of texture on top of that, which I think is like, it's just, that's the vocal sound that everyone hears these days, whether it's on the radio or even live. That's what people want. Genre specific, I think in opera, you certainly wouldn't be doing that.
Right.
But again, in pop and across a lot of genres, that's the kind of tonal texture that people enjoy listening to vocally, whether you're on kind of boom mics or handhelds. If you're going for, so Mary Poppins is complete opposite of that. There's very tra- very tonally transparent, even though there's still a fair amount of amplification going on. You don't notice it because the way everything's balanced, you just allow yourself to kind of buy into what you're hearing, kind of relax and let the show kind of happen. And you don't get disturbed by a tonal balance that is kind of pulling your ear out of the story and pulling you kind of in the wrong direction emotionally. I think tonal balance and emotion and kind of connection go really like hand in hand. So it's something I focus on in a big way.
You had mentioned earlier back when you were an associate that if there was a change in cast, that might be a time where you're doing more. Michelle just went to go to a show this weekend and the lead was sick, so not available. So there was an understudy. When that happens, when your main character, main singer is not going to be in a show, are you having different preset mixes? Because from what you're talking about, there's so many variables with mic placement and all of that. And with six being handheld mics, how are you accounting for that, or are you accounting for that?
Yeah, absolutely. So each person in the company will have their own like channel strip, as it were, their own kind of complete set of settings right through the chain, and that'll be worked on as hard as it would be if the main six, as it were. The company's in six quite deep. There's kind of almost two sets of queens, really, in terms of like the kind of main company and then the alternates. And a lot of people have covering multiple roles, that will mean they'll sing in a different way for each role, and that tonality will be slightly different for each role. So again, we just kind of go through it, set each person up for each role, and then that's stored into the console and kind of easily kind of recallable. So we'll set all that up at the top of the day when we get what's called the cut sheet, and we know who's in and who's out. So the same goes for the musicians as well. Everybody has a different touch. Everybody has a different like internal velocity. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one of the big requirements of the sound department who run the show on a day to day. We usually have three people on a sound team. And the role of the sound mixer will be to essentially recreate that show on any given day with the variables that are coming at them in real time. So
it's very dynamic.
We can account for a certain amount of unknowns, but then we're always working with a live performance, and it's live theater at the end of the day.
It's funny. I was just actually listening to when Six was performing at the Tonys, and one of the performers was out last minute due to COVID, and I think the dance captain stepped in to play one of the roles. Yeah. And I was thinking, oh my God, how many variables can you just, not only is it a last minute cancellation, somebody stepping in, I don't know if it's the main alternate or if this was just somebody that kind of had to step in. Did they have their own in-ears and mix, and it's a new venue because it's at the Tony, so it's not your usual venue and it's a condensed version of the songs. How do you account for very, I would call it emergency situations?
Yeah, I mean, most of the kind of the alternates are super well rehearsed, and they can like flip in at any moment, you know. And also, we'll even get kind of alumni coming back into the show at last minute, or someone coming over from America to fill a spot because there might be a certain combination of people that aren't available. They can flip in and be, you know, right in the moment at any one time, and we can account for that as well. They all have their own IEMs. I think on a show like Six, where you've got six people kind of fundamentally fighting for the same sonic real estate, kind of the only way to really do it is with an IEM solution to provide that kind of control and isolation for each person. Not only does it cut down kind of stage noise, but it also kind of aids like vocal health. Someone's not trying to like keep their head above the kind of the noise, as it were, constantly and pushing. So it's all about managing volume, giving people the space that they need to sing in, and then placing everything else around that in terms of music and the rest of the queens vocally.
Is that changing what you have to do if you're going from a setting where the performers are using in-ears compared to using on stage or around stage monitors? Are the mixes different because the monitors create their own effect within the ear?
Not for us out front, but obviously it's something that we have to pay a lot of attention to for the performer. We have to kind of recreate that ambience, as it were. in our IEMs, we might use different ports, which will allow some ambient sound back in. So different people have different responses to the kind of occlusion. Some don't mind it at all if they might maybe had IEM experience before. But if it's an actor coming into the show with none, it can feel like a very different, isolated environment. So we'll work with kind of reverb, ambient mics that we have in the room, different ports in the ears to kind of balance the kind of level of ambience that they feel comfortable with.
And talking about those features of the in-ears, are you having those conversations with the equipment manufacturers? Are there ever audiologists that are consulted? Because from our experience, most musicians and even sound engineers, the knowledge base they have on in-ears is from the companies, from the manufacturers, and what they're telling them. And so many artists don't even know about the features that can specifically benefit their role within a band or a production.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that we have to, whenever we start with a new company member or like a new kind of cast change, we'll do what we call kind of IEM chat because there's a lot of information that has to be kind of imparted on what the purpose is for using them, what the pluses are, what the minuses are, and where we should be managing like level exposure and, how what the benefits are versus the kind of drawbacks because it's not a perfect solution. There are some downsides, and we also have audiologists around the each kind of territory that we have a show in. We use kind of one audiologist to send people to get their impressions taken, and then sent off to the manufacturer.
And are
But it's
those
been a huge learning curve for us as well because that's probably the one of the it's the first time that I've used IEMs kind of that much, and we've probably got eight productions around the world now, and so we've kind of ordered hundreds of IEMs in the past kind of 6 years, so we've kind of built up our knowledge as well, and working out the kind of repairs and the kind of breakages because the show has a huge choreographic element as well, which can be quite tough on IEMs. And if someone just puts them down too hard on the table, they'll smash. So it can be quite tricky to manage, but ultimately, I think it does provide the best kind of outcome and performance kind of environment for each.
And do the actors take or have the opportunity to practice with them? They
Yeah,
choose
absolutely.
to?
We'll do some IEM show watches. So they'll kind of, whilst they're in rehearsal, but they've not kind of gone into the show yet, they'll do a show in the wings wearing the IEMs and a pack. And they can kind of use the cue mode on the pack to kind of flip through the different mixes and hear what each person's kind of listening to and get a sense of what that is. And we also, as well as using it as a monitoring device, we also use it as a cueing device. So the MD will speak to the company through their ears. They'll give them cues. So instead of kind of counting out loud or giving hand signals, it all makes it quite seamless. So they can kind of count in, give them pickups direct to their ears, basically.
Is there an effort made to conceal them at all, or is it just, hey, you need them and it's going to be part of the
Yeah,
show?
they're designed into the show, really. So I don't know if you've seen any pictures online, but they're all color-coded to each of the Queen's character colors. So Aragorn is gold, Boleyn is green, Seymour is silver, so on and so forth. And they're very kind of sparkly and bright, and they're meant to be. We lean in with the microphone as well. We very much lean into the pop sensibility. So the microphone is fully kind of jeweled and sparkly, as are the IEMs.
You had mentioned that the microphones actually provide some benefits to the vision or sound you're trying to achieve in terms of the frequencies. Are there any downsides or things you've had to manage with having them use the handheld mics? Because that's definitely less common in Broadway theater.
Yeah, it's definitely a stylistic choice. We kind of worked it out in the early days how we'd work manage it with the choreography, and obviously you can't always have one hand taken up with a microphone. So, in collaboration with Gabby, a costume designer, and Carrie Anne, a choreographer, choreographer, Carrie-Anne kind of worked out the choreography with when the mic needs to be there, it will be there. But when it can be put away, it will be put into a little loop, which is on their belt. And you can't really see it. So they'll just kind of choreographically put it into the holster and kind of take it back out again. And again, that can be done slowly, quickly. It can be worked into the actual, narrative of the show.
Yeah, I was watching at one point. I my favorite song changes every day for six, but right now it's Lose Your Head. And when the original Andrea was singing it, and she's bouncing up and down with her arms, I was like, how is it not providing? How does it not capture all the stage noise? How is it just capturing her voice? And that must be all you that's controlling it.
Yeah, it's a high quality kind of DPA microphone with a kind of tight pickup pattern, so we're not getting a lot of like leakage. And again, kind of testament to the Queens that mic technique is everything really with this show. If it moves by an inch, it changes the level and the frequency response. So they're trying to do all that choreography by keeping like the mic in the same place. So it becomes like a natural thing. But it's something that we have to like provide kind of feedback on and just gently remind, and also not to hold the mic in a certain way that changes its frequency response and things like that.
It's one of those skills I never knew that Broadway actors needed to have.
There was I don't know if you know a show called Spring Awakening, which was quite famous for kind of using handheld mics as like a storytelling device quite early on, and no one had really done it before. So going to handhelds can be a very like good contrast, like visually and sonically.
Sure.
It can create a completely different texture. It can snap things into a different place. And obviously it's quite common nowadays. But obviously on six, it's super important. And we never kind of drop that pretense, as it were. The queens are always speaking to the audience through their microphone. So they're as Beyoncé would on stage when she's kind of conversing with the crowd
Sure.
mid song. So we never go to like head mics or booms for kind of dialogue. So that competition that they're all having between themselves, and they're kind of talking to the audience, that's the fundamental premise of the show, kind of from a sound design
It's
perspective.
I'm thinking about it. We're talking about the different venues, certainly in on West End versus Broadway. But when the show is traveling on tour, and there's so much physically that is on stage, but when you're a traveling show, we were speaking recently with Gareth Owen, who had said that you really need to simplify when it goes on tour. You need to simplify your sound, your staging. So what gets compromised when you take the show on tour?
I think definitely the size of the system, especially in America, it kind of works on different time scales. It has to move quickly. It's very expensive to move. You have to package things in a way that can roll in and be kind of working within a few hours. And we'll use things like pre-built kind of systems in towers. Everything gets prepped in the rental shop ahead of time. So you use that time to kind of pre-prepare and work out what's going to take time when you get into a house and that you haven't seen before. Most of the time the guys who are moving the show around will go into theater they haven't seen before. So they've got to assess the room, work out the coverage, work out kind of where to put things, where they can put things. So yeah, you need to be nimble and not overcomplicated for sure, but also effective, because you want the person at the back of the balcony to have a great experience, as well as the person in the middle of the orchestra level.
Are there things that you can take from a traveling show setup that can then translate or be implemented into a fixed show setup? Is there crossover where you can kind of develop your skills in having to do things differently?
I think you get more scope when a show is sitting down to be as kind of creative as you possibly can. When a show is on tour, you do have to limit that slightly. And you try and put the show out. Some producers will put the West End show out on the road, and it will have enough time to be loaded in properly, have kind of enough rehearsal time, enough time to get everyone's into the right place. But most tours will kind of move into the show and open that night or maybe the next day. That's probably the kind of the baseline. But on a show like Mary Poppins, that does have time to be kind of loaded in on a Sunday and then open on a kind of Wednesday, Thursday. because it is a very kind of technically complicated show. But then that gives us the scope to be able to do what we did in basically in the West End and take that around the country, which is great.
You're going from show to show where one show is in one country, one show is in another country, and different countries have different cultures around music and sound and preferences that the American ear is tuned into something different than the African ear or the Asian ear or different areas of Asia and Africa. Are you thinking about that in your production? Are you getting local input? How do you manage the cultural perceptions of music for the shows you're doing?
Yeah, I've definitely experienced times where perhaps in some countries the intelligibility needs to be a bit more heightened than I would have probably thought it needed to be normally, because there's just kind of more consonants in the language, or there's more kind of detail in the kind of S's and T's and the quieter sounds of the voice that just need that level of kind of reinforcement. So I think it's definitely a thing. For the most part, it's generally kind of okay. Haven't really had any problems with it, but it's definitely something. I think culturally, also people have a different sonic expectation sometimes. I think music-wise, if you could look at US versus UK, there's a definite difference in the sound of the radio, for instance. So like in the US, radio airplay is like very kind of low end, heavy. Kind of weighty and kind of high impact. In the UK it might be a bit lighter sounding, maybe a bit brighter on the top end.
Interesting.
I think the American ear can possibly enjoy a bit less high frequency. That may be the natural kind of sonic inclination. Whereas kind of British music is a bit kind of brighter and it's kind of produced and mixed in a slightly different way. I think even those styles are probably converging much more nowadays because there is so much kind of crossover. And with everything being on streaming, it homogenizes into the same kind of place. But yeah, definite different kind of tonal expectations, I think, in some
Interesting.
places.
In all the work you've done, is there anything that you've accomplished that has been that you've been particularly proud of this was a really challenging thing to do, and we did it. We got the vision we wanted.
The show that's actually just closed in the West End called Why Am I So Single was a kind of challenging but very kind of rewarding process. Brand new kind of music straight into the West End, which is quite brave nowadays because normally you do a kind of tryout out of town somewhere and you'll get time to kind of refine it in a safer space away from kind of internet but that was a very, very poppy kind of big bandy hybrid orchestral score, a lot of different kind of elements that needed to come together with an on-stage band again, a lot of pop production. We that actually from the same writers as Six, Toby and Lucy. So that was their kind of second venture, brand new music. So there was kind of them as the writers, Joe Beaton as our orchestrator, and then a production duo called Future Cut, who kind of added a lot of the pop production element. And the score was pretty much created in the studio, and then it was our task to kind of bring that into the live environment, work out how to do it with a live band, minimal kind of track elements and samples. So it had to be all kind of played live and, organically, as it were. So I think that's one of my proudest kind of sonic achievements. There was another show that we did called The Little Big Things, which is again kind of epic sounding kind of anthemic kind of theatre score. I hope we get to do that again one day because I was really happy with that kind of how that turned out.
That's awesome. And we before we had actually started recording, you had said that you're working on you're in the earlier stages of something right now. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, so I'm in the northwest of England in a lovely town called Chester, at a really nice theatre called The Story House, and we're just about to start a show called The Parent Agency, which is a brand new musical where children live in a place called Youngden, and they kind of choose their parents, if you like, and parents have to audition for the role of being the parent. So it's kind of flipped on its head. Lots of different musical styles again, really kind of leaning into every kind of style from kind of vaudeville through to pop and rock. So really kind of varied score to get our teeth into, and again be part of that kind of building process and creation.
It must be very fun for you and an exciting challenge to get to tackle projects that are all very different from each other. It just no two projects are the exact same. I can imagine it being a fun thing to tackle.
Yeah, I love the kind of variance of it. I don't kind of try and put myself in too small a box. I love orchestral music. I love pop music. Any style, I'd love to get my kind of teeth into, really. Everything has its own kind of set of challenges, and but essentially, I'm always trying to get the sound that I hear in my head to happen in the real world. You know, it's kind of everyone hears music in their head in a certain way, and it's kind of getting it to sound like that so you can create that kind of emotional, you know, response is the kind of the kind of baseline of everything, really.
We've heard that idea from stage musicians also when we talk about how do you write your music. It's like there's just an idea and now I need to find it on the guitar and make it
Yeah.
sing.
Yeah, it's a
Speak
lot of
to us.
searching, and you do have those moments where things just kind of pop and they just happen and lock into place. You might think that things are not sounding right for ages, but it just takes time for everyone to kind of find their feet, and then everything just comes together because we can't make things sound good unless everyone's feeling good and performing in the best way. And when everyone's firing on all cylinders, that's when kind of the magic happens in theatre, really. And that's one of the kind of best moments about doing what I do is those moments when those things happen live. You might get a fantastic like preview or an opening night, and everyone's like looking at each other going, "Yeah, that was great, wasn't it?" Everyone felt it, you know.
This is a common thing that we hear when it comes to sound, and sound is so innate to us, and not just in terms of being another sense. And we've talked about this on other podcasts, how sound and music is across cultures, it's across time, it's across cognitive ability, it exists everywhere. And here you get to have a role in creating and working with it. And when you're talking about those moments where it's magical, so you're doing your job as well as you feel like you can do it. So then the singer has this mix they feel is perfect. So then they're doing a great job, which then makes your job easier. It's this wonderful thing of picking up inertia and momentum. Talk a little bit about the differences you encounter, because you work in a lot of environments, whether it's studio, whether it's live theater, whether it's taking theater to then be a film production. Talk about how it is to navigate those different environments to create that sound you hear in your head.
Yeah, I do like going across different kind of disciplines. I do work in the kind of music production and audio post-production as well. It's great to be able to take a show and then re kind of imagine it for a different format. There's a big kind of movement of shows being streamed now and recorded in a really good way. So kind of multi-camera, full multi-track audio capture, full post-production. So you have to take then what you had in the theatre, what you experienced in the theatre, and make that basically come out of two speakers. So it's a lot of distillation and rebuilding of the picture to create the same kind of emotional impact, because you don't have the same dynamic range, you don't have the same like low frequency available unless it's kind of cinema. So for kind of home entertainment, you're basically just, again, just getting what is in here to come out of two kind of, you know, loudspeakers and kind of move you in the same way. And it was a conscious choice to try and work in those fields, because then I can bring all that back into the theatre, and knowing what people enjoy when they listen to music on their earbuds or their headphones, it's getting that experience back into the live world. You know, that kind of feeling of size and bass and low end and envelopment is ultimately what that just goes across all the different, that's the kind of circle that I would kind of work in, really.
If I heard correctly, Six is being turned into a movie. They're filming it live with the original West End actors and releasing it in cinemas. Can you tell us a bit about that in terms of how that came to be, how that was filmed? Were you involved in that at all? Tell us about it.
Yeah, that was actually done a couple of years ago. So they arranged for the original UK company to come back together. And we did a special 3 nights of a special concert actually at Hampton Court, because there was a festival going on there that we kind of were able to tack on to, you know, and be part of the kind of one of the festival lineup. So we did some special kind of live concerts, and then the show kind of closed in the West End for a week, and we filmed several passes of the show, and then a couple of passes with an audience. My capacity with that was on as a sound designer, so facilitating the capture along with the production team. And it was actually a friend of mine who did the audio post-production on that. So it kind of leaves me, if you like, and then it's kind of down to a completely different set of people to put their stamp on it.
Mm-hmm.
When we did reopen Broadway post-pandemic, we were lucky enough to do, I think, one of the first live albums on opening night. So we recorded the show, and then I was pretty adamant that I wanted to do the post-production on that and be one of the audio producers, because, you know, I am very passionate about it. It's something I feel very, you know, personally about. That was about recreating the sense of being in that theater when you listen to the album.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately we got nominated for a Grammy for that. So it kind of, you know, it went really well, and it's something that is out there and kind of lives on as its own thing. And I enjoy nothing more than people getting pleasure out of something that I've worked on, you know, and I've been a part of making someone feel good or have an emotional response, or, you know, then goes home after the show and just thinking about the show, thinking about it the next day. And they may not realize why, but we've all kind of fed into that. And it's just that's kind of why I do what I do, basically.
That's what it's all about. And specifically with Six, there are a few Broadway shows where I'll go home at the end of the day and like choose to turn the soundtrack back on. And Six was one of the very few where, and I chose to listen to the live soundtrack. There's something exciting about the audience being kind of in the background, but still being able to capture or hear the vocalist and the instrumentals very, very clearly, but you know that the actor is in, they're feeding off the crowd and you can hear it in their voice. So
yeah, that was definitely one of the big briefs for that, is that the audience had to be one of the characters, because there's so much back and forth, you know,
yeah,
and there's so much interaction and interplay. So they to get that balance, you know, we had to kind of record the audience really well and really in a detailed fashion with a lot of kind of microphones around the house and picking up kind of close perspectives, far perspectives. And as that album goes through its arc, then, as you say, you feel like you're in the space and you can feel the power of the singer, but also the reaction of the audience.
I could only imagine how much emotion was in the audience then, based on the conversation we had with Meg about when Wicked opened back up, and how they were what, like 15 or 20 minutes behind schedule because the audience was so into it, that it seems like a brilliant time to be recording live to distribute and release, because there's so much energy there. Being that your professional life revolves around your ears and your hearing, is there anything specific you do to be mindful or take care of your ears?
Yeah, absolutely. And as I've got into my kind of mid-40s, it's something that I'm uber aware of.
We love it.
I'm aware of my own age-related hearing loss. You know, there's no getting away from it. When you get to 40, you start to lose some stuff. That's not necessarily a problem, because you just have, as long as you have a kind of relative reference point, but then you've also got other people that you work with who can be a different relative reference point.
Mm-hmm.
But when I get on the kind of underground or any like kind of noisy situations, I'll use kind of noise cancelling earphones or hearing protection. The minute I kind of feel any kind of, you know, uncomfortable, I probably did overexpose myself when I was young, as we probably
all
did in discos and clubs too,
yep.
You know, too. So there's kind of a bit of environmental damage that has crept in.
Mm-hmm.
I did have an audiogram probably about 10 years ago now, so I'm probably due for another one. But it's a funny kind of thing because, in a way, I don't really want to know, because then it gets into my own head
We hear that a lot.
about what you're missing.
Yep.
And is it better to just know what I know now and not kind of overthink it, you know? But I've seen some interesting things about kind of hearing regeneration. I'm interested to kind of explore that a bit more. I think as science develops, hopefully maybe I'll get some of it back. That would be awesome. But yeah, it's something I'm very aware of. And
Excellent.
I'm very aware of it when I work with people as well. I never want people to be overexposed to, you know, whether it's musicians or actors and especially audiences. So I'm always kind of conscious of working at comfortable levels, not diminished levels, you
Sure.
know, but knowing where the pocket is and knowing how appropriate that SPL pocket is for the content that you're working with and the story that you're trying to tell.
That all makes sense. And Paul, thank you so much for your time today and being a guest on Hear Us Out. I think we learned a lot, and I'm sure our audience did as well. And your work sounds
Pleasure.
absolutely fascinating. And we've luckily gotten to see some of the shows and hear the music that you've had a role in creating and making so sonically enjoyable for us.
I
So
appreciate that
thank
very
you.
much. Yeah. Thank you for having me on.
And why don't you just tell our audience where they can find you, where they can find more information about you, or how they can connect with you?
Yeah, I've got a kind of website, paulgatehouse.co.uk, or a kind of probably Instagram is the best place to kind of get a hold of me if anyone wants to chat. I try and give kind of opportunity where I can. Students want to reach out and kind of shadow some of the shows, so that we try and do a lot of that. It's not always possible, but when we can, I was very conscious of opportunities I received when I was young, so anytime I can, I will kind of try and work that into what we do.
Excellent. And we'll link to those in the description of the episode. So, again, thank you so much. And we really appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks, Michelle.
And
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
we will look forward to, I think the release date for the movie is in April, so we will.
Yes.
Well, we're not there in the UK, but for people in the UK who are listening, go see it in April when it releases, and we'll hear about it and we'll read about it.
Yeah, hopefully it'll come over stateside soon enough. Or
It always
be released
eventually does.
on, or be released on streaming. I don't know what the plans are, but yeah, hopefully we'll get to see
Awesome.
it soon.
Thank you so much for taking the time today. We really appreciate it. We've enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you, me too.